Hello everyone, I'm Tara. We have been discussing international business environment and the various aspects of the whole chain of this transport and business of goods and services across borders. We have also been seeing India's participation in it, India's dynamic with its trading partners, and various socio-political, economic, geopolitical, other aspects that come into play. So we will continue to discuss this. Now, as with any other aspect of economic development, world over, there are developed economies, there are developing economies, emerging economies, and then there are also poor nations. So clearly, there are bodies required, there is support required for the global trade to happen, for someone to play mediator, for someone to play supporter. Otherwise, it would be very imbalanced, which it is already, but it would be even more imbalanced because you would have some nations which have their resources, which are more developed and which could end up having a crazy undue advantage versus other nations which are not that developed, which don't have that that many resources, which do not have access to that much finance. So it would become extremely imbalanced. And not only that, developed nations, despite their resources, access to finance, all of those aspects, cannot prosper without the development of other nations, because you need trading partners as well, right? So even if in isolation you are doing well, unless you have thriving trading partners across the globe, you yourself are not really going to be able to benefit from it. So we are going to be discussing today organizational support and how various entities like the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, Asian Development Bank, etc., how they come and participate and help countries across the world to prosper, to give them some sort of footing to get their businesses going, help poorer nations come out of extremely challenging situations, and support this whole international trade environment that we are discussing. Institutional support we need to know about, because institutional support is extremely vital, as I said, not just for the poor and developing nations, but also for developed nations. And it's very important to know how organizational support has evolved, how organizational support across the centuries, across the decades and almost a century has participated, and how different regions are accessing it, tapping into it, and how the different regions have their separate organizational support also, in addition to the central organizational support entities like the World Bank. So coming to the World Bank, now we are all aware of World War II and the destruction that happened in Europe, in US, in Japan, as a result of, even though you had parts which were isolated physically from the war in ways, but the destruction was impacted those countries as well. So we know the absolute calamity and catastrophe that happened during the World War, and it left the global economy in absolute shambles. It left the world, large parts of the world, in absolute poverty. So there was a need for an entity to come in and reconstruct the world. So this was, the World Bank was formed initially by 38 nations. Now practically every nation in the world is part of the World Bank. But in 1946, when it was initially conceptualized, the idea was to rebuild the world after the World War II and rebuild USA and Japan specifically. 38 members at that point of time joined this. And the idea was to give some life into the economies, infrastructure, industrialization, development, and survival of these countries and their citizens. So initially it was called, as you know, we have been talking, the theme was to reconstruct USA, Japan, and the rest of the world. Initially, it was called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, that is IBRD. And the idea was also to lend to governments of middle-income countries and low-income countries. Now, also keep in mind that when we are talking about the business of lending, and definitely when it comes to a bank, then business of lending is the primary, is one of the primary roles. Now, when we're talking about the business of lending, then yes, there is lending. But whenever there's lending involved, there is also repayment, which is important. Even these banks have a balance sheet. Even these banks have to, even the World Bank has to have a repayment at some stage. You cannot just have an outflow of funds and no recovery, because that is not a sustainable model. It is not a charitable organization. It is an enabling organization which wants to ensure that it gives the support when needed, but eventually when countries are on their feet, find their feet, then that money should come back as well, which is why you see the term creditworthiness. Now, creditworthiness is important to understand, that eventually once the support has helped these economies grow, helped these low-income countries grow, then they will, once they stand on their own feet, start repaying this money and become, start reducing the debt burden, or, become debt free. Now, obviously, the way banks lend with repayment, you know, if you go and take a consumer loan from a bank, or if a corporate goes and takes a working capital loan from the bank. Now, those are shorter term versus the lending which is done by a World Bank. You know, World Bank lending will typically not have any repayment for the first 15 to 20 years, because these, the whole idea is to allow the countries, the beneficiary countries, to build their economies. So typically, when it comes to the lending by World Bank and other entities, the repayment term, first of all, the term of these loans is very long, 20, 30, 40 years. And for a very, very long time initially, 10, 15, 20 years, there is no repayment. Repayment actually starts post that. So, so while creditworthiness of these economies is assessed and one wants repayment, at the same time, they are given that time to be able to repay. So for instance, when you talk about India as a borrower, India is the largest borrower from the World Bank. Clearly, we are the most populous country. But if you see the net borrowing year on year, actually the most of our net borrowing, most of our outstanding borrowing has happened in, not in the last 10 years, but before that. And gradually, as our economy has improved, gradually as our ranking, creditworthiness to the world has improved, we have managed to reduce the net inflow of fresh borrowing from the World Bank. And also, because of our creditworthiness, been able to access other capital markets across the globe other than the World Bank and get favorable terms from them. So it's important to remember that that initial long tenor which is required so that the countries can develop before they start repaying, India has delivered on that in terms of, yes, being the largest outstanding largest borrower with outstanding debt, but also the dynamic, if you see, we are not among the highest recent borrowers. Most of this outstanding debt is from easily 15 to 20 years ago. So when we talk about the International Development Association, these give concessional loans to the poorest countries. Now we've heard of countries like Sierra Leone, your Guinea, your various other parts of Africa. We have Niger, etc. Now, when you have extremely poor countries, then while access to finance is important for them, at the same time, that finance cannot be given to them just as a quantum. It has to also come at concessional and sub lending rates, because the same lending rate, interest cost that is levied on India cannot be levied on a poorer nation like the Cameroon. You can't do that. So poorer nations need concessional loans, sometimes zero interest loans, and also there are various initiatives by various arms of the World Bank to give a chance to these countries, poorer countries, to actually be able to reduce that debt burden by ticking certain boxes or meeting certain targets, which give them credit for having achieved those and then reducing their debt burden vis-a-vis the entity, or actually giving them certain waivers in terms of that debt burden. So the whole system of how the financing works is very specific to country and region. You cannot have the way you see, okay, consumer finance loan going at this rate, the bank lending rate is this and the bank lending rate plus 1%. You cannot have a standardized rate which is applicable to all countries. You have to have different rates. You have to have different terms. You have to have different tenors. Over and above the financing, you also have to provide them, these countries, with the knowledge and the support and sometimes even the managerial expertise to be able to use this financing appropriately. Now, a lot of this financing would be going towards developmental projects, poverty alleviation projects, which are a lot of poverty alleviation projects, a lot of environment saving projects. Now, just because you're providing the finance, the country may not be in a position to suitably utilize this finance to achieve the outcome of the intended project. So organizations like International Finance Corporation, World Bank, etc., you would see that these projects are not just financed, but also overseen, monitored and operated by various smaller organizations, various managements under these larger World Banks, IFCs, ADBs, etc. Now, if a World Bank is lending, then clearly World Bank needs to borrow money also, right? So because where is the money coming from? To lend money, they have to be borrowers also. So World Bank is a borrower. Because the World Bank has a very good credit standing, very good credit worthiness, they borrow from larger capital markets across the globe and get very favorable terms. Now, because they get very favorable terms, they are in a position to onward support poorer nations, developing nations, lower income nations with more favorable terms versus what other capital markets would be able to offer to these countries. You have the MEGA, which seeks to encourage foreign direct investment. Now, again, when we were talking about the FDI, then in India, we saw that post-liberalization and continuing, the kind of initiatives that the country was taking as far as making India attractive for foreign direct investment was concerned. Now, likewise, when it comes to MEGA, they assess and see what is the political risk, provide insurance, provide various other support systems so that FDI can be facilitated into your emerging markets, emerging economies, because a lot of the countries themselves may not, the governments of those countries themselves may not be in a position or may not be equipped to create an environment which makes your regulation, your taxation, your infrastructure, various labor laws, etc., your various other factors conducive to attracting foreign investment, foreign direct investment. So in such situations, developing emerging economies, lower income economies need support of these other agencies to be able to create an environment, an enabling support system so that foreign investment is directed to these economies. When we had discussed in a previous chapter regarding Vodafone Hutch deal, which led to a massive tax dispute, which went on for a very long time, and eventually it went to the Hague in the Permanent Court of Dispute Resolution in Hague in Netherlands, the outcome of that, we saw how that whole process took several years, lot of cost, lot of issues, lot of reputational issues for all parties involved, and it is a complex process. So when it comes to international trade, when it comes to lending, borrowing, when it comes to cross-border entities where each one has its own way of doing business, understanding language barriers, taxation, etc., then there is requirement for settlement of international investment disputes, and there are entities which provide this support via conciliation, mediation, etc., to mitigate and to help the countries and cross-border entities move on from that. For example, there is a recent Oxfam study which claims, as per that study, and they have used the UNCTAD's data, as per that study, certain African nations have been cheated by MNCs to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more, by way of tax evasion, by using various artificial mispricing techniques where they have managed to evade the taxes that they should have paid in these nations. Now, there is an international meet in Ethiopia, and the African nations have invited the heads of these countries where these MNCs are based to come and participate in that and discuss and address this issue of massive tax evasion, because that tax evasion is revenue for those African countries, right? Now, these countries, smaller countries, may not have the ability to themselves address this this dispute or take up this issue. So then they need support from other entities and agencies to help them to get involved and help them to address and help them to get these other countries to participate in it, because they may on their own not take these emerging and poorer nations seriously. So when it comes to dispute resolution, definitely the developed economies have a more influential role, have a larger support system and infrastructure, whereas the smaller countries and the lower income countries need someone else to come and handhold when it comes to these larger disputes of international trade and business. Now, we'll be touching on some of the different projects that have been done, undertaken under World Bank, ADB, etc. And a lot of them are going towards financing projects which are not short term in terms of just providing money to eat. They are long term so that they can lead to holistic development over these longer periods of the loan tenors. And that holistic development can lead to upliftment in this area, so that in the region, so that you have a long-term change and those regions become self-sufficient and can sustain their growth in future with lesser and lesser external support. So these could be, and you know, we'll be touching on various projects specific to India also in different states which have been, you know, rolled out. A lot of these projects across the globe and in India pertain to agriculture, you know, gender equality, infrastructure, urban development. When we had the COVID situation, then during COVID situation, a lot of support was required from these international entities to fund projects which went towards addressing the COVID situation. For example, the Asian Development Bank made a 100 million loan to the Medanta hospitals for, you know, addressing the COVID situation, whether it was for purchase of PPEs, whether it was for staff training, whether it was for making, you know, having additional beds for your patients, etc. So these projects and these loans and grants are not for something immediate in terms of, you know, a very short-term, immediate, hand-to-mouth kind of situation. They address situations which come up across the globe and which require a longer-term solution, and which not only help a limited number of people, but create some sort of situation which is helping and uplifting the life of a larger amount of the society which is part of that region. There are various ways in which this disbursement happens from these entities to various projects. It could be by way of reimbursement, by way of advance. Now, for example, in India, there are almost 127 active World Bank projects currently with an investment of roughly $28 billion. Now, you can imagine that the different projects have required different modalities, different structures, and being overseen in with, you know, with a different skill set. So there are the whole idea is to enable and get involved. Now, to give you an idea of the varied kind of projects, as we were seeing, it's right from agriculture to climate to you know, urban development, etc. Now, these among these projects which the World Bank has in India, there are projects as varied as you know, improving road transport in Assam, so that almost you know, 1 to 2 million people can have access to better road transport, which obviously directly helps their lifestyle, their employment, their long-term upliftment of the area. Then there are projects for, we know about water pollution. We know how bad the water pollution is. And there are projects, for example, for the rejuvenation and depollution of the Ganges River. Now, this again is something which is not just symbolic that, you know, the Ganges is sacred to us, but also it is a huge source of our water, a basic life, you know, requirement that we have. So whether whatever the modalities, the variety of the projects that are being undertaken even in a populous country like India, are completely varied, which also gives you an idea of similar kind of projects being undertaken in other emerging markets, in other parts of the world, which are not going towards, you know, corporate expenditure or corporate capital expansion, but more towards alleviation of the life of the people, the common citizens in those areas. So again, you could have direct payments being made by banks, special commitment payments, through third parties, which could be a modality which is being, adopted by the bank. Now, International Monetary Fund, their main role is to ensure stability of the international monetary system, the system of exchange rates, etc. As I was mentioning earlier, that the dollar is the largest reserve currency of the world. The euro comes second, but the dollar is has almost a 60% contribution in terms of being the reserve currency of the world. And also there, you have threats from persons like Donald Trump, who have restricted the world's ability to move away from these reserve currencies. There was a discussion happening between some countries, including India, to de-dollarize their transactions, to move to other currencies when dealing with certain partners, which may be more beneficial for them financially. But in response to that, again, Donald Trump had issued severe warnings that certain such kind of de-dollarization discussion should not be entertained. So right now he's not in power. We don't know who will come in power, what sort of policies will happen. But clearly, given all the currencies, the dynamics of the exchange rates, etc., world over, maintaining exchange stability, system of international payments becomes very, very sensitive, and there is need for a central, fair, standardized mechanism to ensure that there is no unfair benefit to certain parties at the cost of smaller countries and parties. Now, other roles of IMF over financial stability are to create, employment, sustainable economic development. We keep seeing the recurring theme of poverty alleviation, because there is a very, while the world wealth has grown, while global trade has grown, imports and exports have grown, the income imbalance is absolutely shocking in terms of how imbalanced it is. And in large parts of the world, the rich have become richer and the poor have become poorer. So poverty alleviation, even now, so many years after serious industrialization started in the late 1800s, and so many centuries later also, we have seen that poverty is still an issue. One would have thought that poverty, at least basic poverty, in terms of having a roof over your head, in terms of having your meals provided, your basic sanitation provided, even that is something which still, even after so many centuries and decades, is still a real problem across the world. So poverty alleviation for all these entities, whether it is World Bank, IMF, ADB, etc., for everyone is a huge priority. Now, the IMF again has undertaken initiatives and targets to specifically help these poorer nations with giving them credits for meeting certain targets, and for hence then being eligible for certain more concessions, waivers, etc. Some of the mechanisms by which lending happens is standby arrangement, extended facilities, RFIs, different modalities for how this international, these international grants, loans, etc. happen, and different models would be used for different projects and different countries. Again, poverty reduction being a major priority, these are some of the ways in which concessional lending happens. There are times when concessional loans carry zero interest, and there are several of them which have very low interest. And as I was saying earlier, the repayment actually starts way decades after the loans are disbursed. So that gives time to the countries to move out of their impoverished situations and hopefully be better. For example, if we look at the tiger economies or the tiger cub economies now, then tiger economies had such rapid growth in a matter of few decades. So they have definitely managed to cross that, use those concessional loan decades to be able to come to a situation where today they may no longer be considered low income. When you talk about Vietnam, there's so much discussion around Vietnam, which is a tiger cub economy. When you talk about so many of these countries, there is such rapid growth happening there that they are really being able to sustain this poverty reduction, this general growth initiatives which are being undertaken by entities like World Bank, IMF, ADB, etc.